I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle, which is coming right up, but first a few thoughts of my own. Rich people, ultra-rich people, unbelievably, enormously, unfathomably rich people have a terrible problem with housing. In New York City, they're living 90 floors up in glass boxes at the top of these spindly skyscrapers. I just read that you can get into one of these for a mere $94 million. You get, you get a penthouse and a few extras for $94 million. You get bathtubs that are carved out of Carrara marble. Everywhere else you have blue veined marble. And of course, because you're up there and it's all glass, you assume you can walk around naked. Rich people, it's not going to work. You see that thing outside there, 90 floors up? That's a drone. That's a paparazzi drone. So you're going to be just like people who live at a normal level. And what happens when you're 90 floors up if you want a pizza? Does it come by drone? Does it come by somebody who can't get through the security to deliver it? Or worse still, do you starve if there's an electrical breakdown? No power, no elevator, all the prestige and money in the world waving slightly in the wind. It's such a burden being rich, don't you think? We're going to talk about people in this program who are anything but rich. We're going to talk about people who are incarcerated, people who are hurting in our society, and people who our society hurts without always realizing it. And to lead that discussion, we have a very unique and marvelous young man, Jordan Seabury, who is chairman of the Univocal Legislative Minority Advisory Commission, which is in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to the broadcast. To joining in the conversation, we have my old friend, it's always a joy to see him, Joe Matthew, who's the morning news anchor on WBZ Radio, 10:30 a.m. in Boston. It is the must-listen-to radio station in Boston, and for me, he is the must-listen-to anchor. And of course, the co-host of this program, Linda Gasparello. Welcome to the broadcast, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
People in prison. We have more people in prison in the United States than any other advanced country, about three times more, and the prison sentences are about three times longer. How has this come about?
Well, one of the biggest reasons that we've seen this huge boom in the prison population is the war on drugs. And that was initiated over 40 years ago, obviously, but it was really ramped up by President Reagan and a few specific policies that led municipal police forces to be incentivized to go after what they call low-hanging fruit. So the guys dealing on the corner in alleyways, rather than prioritizing the individuals who are really bringing large amounts of drugs into the country, they're going after the low-hanging fruit. And so what that's meant is that communities of color, low-income communities across the nation have felt the brunt of the war on drugs. So we've got incredible populations of Black and Latinos in particular, Native Americans and Asians serving prison sentences.
There's everybody. I mean, I have a white friend who was incarcerated for drugs years ago. When Nelson Rockefeller was governor of New York State, he introduced minimum sentences.
Exactly.
Interestingly, some of the sentences for drugs were as long as for murder. Murder was 15 years and drugs could be longer, which is rather upside down.
Absolutely. And some of the probationary sentences, parole terms that people serve for drug offenses, you end up serving more time than violent offenses, even some of the most violent offenses. And so the priorities really are upside down, like you said.
I would throw this out and then we'll go to the rest of the panel. During the Vietnam War, you had some movement for prison reform because white middle-class people were being imprisoned and they were saying, my God, this is awful. This is
suddenly
unspeakable.
It's an issue.
And it's an issue.
Right.
And because they could write, they could use the courts, they were what we called at the time the new class, articulate people who wanted to improve things. There were some movements to reform. But as that subsided, as the Vietnam War and the draft protesters went into business and forgot about their that years of activism, prisons got worse, sentences longer, and there became a whole philosophy, I think, Joe, of, well, these are bad people, we'll put them in prison basically for the rest of their lives.
And we should also make the point that these are, in many cases, if not most cases, nonviolent offenders when you're talking about these drug arrests, convictions, incarcerations. But we may be seeing the turning of that tide. It's just been a very messy turn so far. When you look at the change in attitudes toward drug use in this country, particularly marijuana, and the policies that we've seen now in various states, it's this new patchwork where you have something illegal on the federal level, legal in, on the state level for medicinal use, and then legal for recreational use on, in other states. So we've reached true confusion on this issue on an apparent path to progress.
Also, the cost of prisons is very high. What is the cost, absolutely, Jordan, of imprisoning somebody? It's much higher than it is sending them to school or even to
certainly
college.
Certainly, or job training or enrichment activities. Many of the things that could be preventative measures are certainly capsized and priced by prison terms. I don't have national figures, but locally in Rhode Island, the last figure I knew is approximately $45,000 a year per inmate here in Rhode Island to incarcerate an individual.
Which is right up there with the tuition for the best Ivy League colleges.
Exactly.
Right,
remembering
exactly
that they are run by for-profit, publicly traded companies that need to make money.
Right. So really, we have three conditions that are causing this mass incarceration. And the incarceration is really done by the states. So any reform is going to have to be done state by state by state. But the three conditions are communities that see profit in building the prisons. Then you have legislators who see they don't want to be seen as being soft on crime. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing you have is the communities themselves, you know, who really are worried about letting people out on parole, whereas a lot of the prisoners that are there should really be in parole situations. States have become more restrictive when it comes to parole, even though we know that after a certain age, I mean, if you're in prison for a crime at 25, by 35 or 45, you're not going to be the same kind of danger to a community. Right. Why is parole still very restrictive or not allowed at all? What's happening? I suppose the question is, what's happening in terms of parole reform? How can we get that? That seems to be the essence of starting reform with prisons.
Well, and to your point as well, part of the fact that communities are so up in arms when people are released, and there is this huge concern whenever that occurs, that highlights the fact that we already subconsciously know that the prison sentence hasn't rehabilitated people. It hasn't done anything to change the behavior that got folks in there in the first case. So when they are released from prison, and they will be, unless you're serving life without parole, at some point, you will be released into the community. And so what we have to do is prepare the community and prepare the individual to actually not face the barriers that society has put in place. So
right,
you're released and you are unable to, hypothetically, you're unable to find employment because you have to answer, yes, I've been convicted of a felony. And then in many cases, your application goes to the bottom of the pile. You, in many cases, are barred from getting federal student aid to pursue your education. Some states bar you with certain convictions from getting food stamps. Many states bar you from voting, which is the bedrock of what our democratic system is based upon. Mm-hmm. And so you're released, and you face barrier after barrier after barrier, and yet we continue to act surprised when people go back. We set people up for failure, and when we set people up for failure, we're plucking them all from the same communities because of this war on drugs, because we're plucking them from these low-income communities, overwhelmingly low-income communities of color. What we're doing is we're setting up not just that individual, but that entire neighborhood, that entire community, to fall back into that same cycle.
And then, of course, I forgot to mention sentencing. I mean, it's bad enough that parole isn't being reformed, but sentencing also, it's just in the beginning of being reformed. But, you know, there are states like New Jersey and California and New York that have reduced their prison populations by about 25%. What are they doing right?
So many of the, much of the urgency in those cases is financial. We're finding that incarcerating people and trying to enforce our way out of these issues is not working, and it's costing taxpayers immense amounts of money.
One of the incentives to lock them up, though, is with drugs, is the confiscation of property.
Absolutely.
Where police departments are in business locking people up because they confiscate, the state confiscates them, and the police department, yes, more, confiscates cars, boats,
exactly,
houses, all sorts of things, which is a sort of extracurricular punishment on top of whatever the court is going to hand down. There's this loss of property, which is very un-American, by the way.
And it is. And that dispossession that you described isn't necessarily going to hurt the person who's incarcerated. That's going to hurt the family. That's going to hurt neighbors. And that's where we start to see the cyclical violence, because we're dragging other folks into these same conditions and not making the conditions for folks to
You've studied this, Jordan. Is there any country that does this right better?
Yes. Short answer, yes. Long answer is the United States is the leading incarcerator in the world. We incarcerate at a higher rate than anybody else. So you can look virtually anywhere else. But there are many countries. Finland comes to mind. There are a lot of countries in that part of Europe in particular that are really pioneering prisons that are not these incredibly punitive models. But they're based upon ideas of restorative justice and rehabilitation. And inmates have a certain control over their own lives and their own destinies. And people are realizing that nobody wants to commit crime. Nobody wants to perform this antisocial behavior, or sociopathic behavior in some cases. People want to be good, fundamentally, and people are capable of changing. But when we continue to hammer home the idea that you are not welcome here, you are not equal, and you do not deserve to work, you do not deserve to pursue an education, you do not deserve to have safe shelter or food security, when we drive home those points, of course, people, it's a matter of time before we keep these recidivism rates.
And how about the overzealous prosecutors, too? I forgot to mention that. We tend to have prosecutors that want to make their name because they're rising politically. Do we see, anywhere where this is changing? Is there any light at the end of that tunnel?
Absolutely. And that's across the board. So that mindset that people have of being incredibly tough on crime is not just the prosecutors. It's also many police forces who are, again, incentivized, like you just mentioned, by asset seizure and getting paramilitary equipment from the federal government. And this tough-on-crime attitude has been mimicked not only in those areas, but also by legislators who pass mandatory minimum sentencing and take the discretion away from judges and away from the courts and make it so that we have this environment that is so, quote, tough on crime, but it's dumb on crime, really. It's not a method that works. It's not a method that rehabilitates people, and it's not a method that builds peace in communities. It just tears people apart.
Well, you've got a hard message because you've got to appeal to those three communities about how change would actually be something for the good. In a political year, in an election year like this, are you heard a little bit more than in a non-election year?
I think it's always going to be the struggle of community organizers and the struggle of advocates to get heard, regardless of whether it's an election year or not. The political system as it's set up, of course, is going to change the dialogue, but we have to be consistent. And we have to let politicians and let those in power and let those who we're trying to, the voices who we're trying to build, those on the bottom, those in the community, those on the margins, we have to emphasize that these conditions are everyday conditions. We're not talking about something that only takes place during an election year, or something that only takes place when Baltimore is rioting, or only takes place when someone is killed in Ferguson. We're talking about everyday conditions that lead to these boiling points.
We're going to take a little station break, primarily for our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, the POTUS channel 124. And I'd like to mention that Joe Matthew created that channel and introduced me to it, and we're grateful to Joe for that.
I with many others.
No, it was an auteur performance, I think. Anyway, you are listening to White House Chronicle, and our special guest today is the activist Jordan Seabury, chairman of the Univocal Legislative Minority Advisory Commission. Don't try to write it down. If you want to get in touch with him, just find Jordan Seabury on the internet. I found it. It's quite easy to do. Joe Matthew, mentioned a moment ago, who's morning radio news anchor for WBZ Radio 1030 in Boston, the most listened to radio station in that very important market, and in my opinion, one of the most gifted broadcasters we have in the United States. And I'm embarrassing him, but I don't mind. I believe it. And Linda Gasparello, co-host of this program. In addition to seeing this on many PBS stations, you can also view it on a large number of PEG stations, altogether about 200 screens in America and around the world on the Voice of America English language broadcasts of radio and television. Joe, what do you think about this? You mentioned that we've incentivized companies.
That's true.
To build prisons.
You covered Wall Street for a while.
If you build prisons, you want prisoners.
Yes.
And so there's enormous pressure to lock people up.
Absolutely. Sure. There's money to be made. Look, when you're publicly traded, you have to show growth to shareholders. Not just profitability, but continued growth in profitability. And so there is, of course, an urge to grow for the sake of profits and shareholders. But I wonder to what extent this is evolving as we also introduce an opioid crisis in America, which has made this suddenly, if we're focusing in this conversation on the war on drugs feeding incarceration, it has suddenly made this a middle class and in some cases an upper class problem. It's a suburban problem. It's an everywhere problem. When you see high school kids, white high school kids, college kids who have nothing but the world behind them, everything to lose, conducting this kind of risky behavior and causing local fire departments to carry Narcan, this becomes everyone's problem.
How about just older people who can't get prescriptions for pain because their doctors won't prescribe because they're worried about losing their licenses?
Sure.
I mean, they're forced to go out.
The result of that is an increase in heroin use.
Absolutely.
Right.
When the prescription drugs that have come off, they're turning to illicit drugs, and heroin is used in some countries. Britain is one of them, for terminal cases to alleviate pain at the end of life.
But of course
but
they
are. But people are using heroin when they shouldn't use it, and they become almost immediately, not necessarily, but almost always become addicted, or there's a very, very high incidence of addiction. Is this going to change as we see heroin differently, as we see the hard drugs differently in society? Are we, do you think, Jordan, eventually going to see them the way we now see marijuana, which is very different than the way we saw it 50 years ago or 40 years ago or 30 years ago?
I think to answer that concretely would be a lot of speculation on my part. I think the conditions are certainly
there. This is television. You're welcome to speculate.
I mean, the conditions are certainly there for a culture change. We've already seen nationally in such a short period of time a sea change of opinion on marijuana use. You know, states across the country have passed decriminalization efforts, including Rhode Island, as well as obviously Colorado and Washington pioneering regulation. And so I think the conditions are there. And I think that's what we need to be moving towards, because criminalizing something that is a health issue ultimately doesn't get at the root of it.
Does it change perceptions about drug use, though, when it becomes a human problem as opposed to an inner city problem or an African American problem or someone other than me problem?
Absolutely. And that's why we have to challenge ourselves to maintain that communities of color and low-income communities in particular have borne the brunt of the war on drugs for so long. And so now that it becomes a, quote, everyone problem, or a problem that now affects people who are not racial minorities or who are not living in low-income communities, now that it affects those folks, those populations, now it becomes an issue that affects legislators. It affects people on TV, people on radio, people who hold middle class jobs. Mm-hmm. And so obviously that changes the perception, but what we have to make sure we do is that we don't suddenly think of this as some new issue. And it's tragic that we see an impetus for change come only when it becomes an issue that doesn't just affect communities of color and mm-hmm. just affect low-income communities, because what we should be doing is we should be judging ourselves based on how we care for and how we treat those who have the least. And those who have the least, communities of color and low-income communities, have, since the inception of the war on drugs, been hit the hardest, been devastated the most. And so it's sort of maybe a tragic irony that now that there are issues moving into the suburbs, now that there are issues moving into white America, that suddenly the conversation is changing. Mm-hmm. That's good, and it affects all of us in a way that we can start to change our perceptions about it. Good can come out of that. But also it's tragic that it required decades of devastation on the part of communities of color as well.
Do you get more support for your work as a result of that change? Do you find that you're getting more funding from communities you never expected you would get funding from as a result of that change in society?
Well, so to speak for myself, the Univocal Commission has no funding. We are not, everything is done on a volunteer basis. So all of the work that we do legislatively, working on the Community Police Relations Act and other legislative initiatives, is entirely volunteer.
This is in Rhode Island, but do you have similar organizations in other states?
Absolutely. So there are partner organizations across the country. And I think what we do see is we see the conversation change. We see a culture change on how we understand things. And that's natural, because once it starts to affect me, if I'm a middle class, white American who works on Wall Street or whatever the case may be, suddenly if it's affecting my son, now it's personal. But what that indicates is that we have a long way to go on building the political power of those low-income communities that we're working on.
I want to change the conversation.
Can I just ask one thing?
Yeah, sure.
Are you partnering with other groups, like, for instance, the Brennan Center in New York, which really deals a lot with prison reform and with sentencing reform and, all of the issues we've discussed so far? Do you partner with these to give your voice more power?
Absolutely. So in particular, to speak only for myself and the Univocal Commission, we are based on an alliance model. So one of the things that I'm seeing encouraging about this conversation change is that we are a coalition of organizations pushing for legislative change. And that is a model that can be built nationally.
Right.
So that is something that can be taken state by state and then on a national level as well, where we leverage the resources and the power of organizations who are embedded in the communities most affected, and we can build legislative change that way. So, absolutely.
I'd like to go to the front end of this, and that is the police. Mm-hmm. The police are very important in this, and relationships with the police and communities are not doing very well. We've seen Ferguson, we've seen Baltimore. There are various, and yet we are sympathetic to the police because they have a terribly difficult, dangerous, and in many ways thankless job. I talked to several policemen and former policemen, and they sort of shrug. They say there's a lot of brutality, there's a lot of stepping over the line, and of course there's a lot of abuse they take, they're very, very upset, and then when you get a lot of public acrimony about their conduct, they feel more isolated, more persecuted, and yet they have to go out there on the front lines. In Baltimore, we see murders, and it's suspected that the police, after the troubles, are not enforcing the law with the vigor they once did because they're very unhappy and partly because they do not wish to be prosecuted. Do you have an answer or some ideas about the police?
Well, I mean, the police are sort of the most visible arm of the system, of law enforcement. But they're really only one piece. We, like you mentioned, we have the prosecutors who are involved. We have judges who have an incredible amount of discretion and power. And all of those play into disparities within the criminal justice system and within incarceration. But I think looking at the police, who do have a difficult job and who do have a dangerous job, but we sort of set them up for failure in a lot of ways. We set police forces up to be villainized, and we set police forces up so that those relationships with the community are virtually impossible when you have this quota of arrests you have to make, or you have this incentive to seize assets from low-hanging drug dealers, to seize cars and cash. You know, you're incentivized to harass. You're incentivized to look at everybody in the community as a suspect, as a potential criminal. And so really, we set ourselves up to be at odds with the police, and then it boils over, as we've seen. And brutality on the police part is real.
Joe, you and I have both covered the police in our time. What are your feelings about the police? I'm very, very conflicted. I think they have this terrible job, and they step over the line. And yes. It's not, by the way, Jordan, just with African Americans. Linda and I had a friend in Virginia who was severely, appallingly beaten by that. And he was a white local youth. And he was, I've never seen a man in such bad shape.
Right. And I think
the old resisting arrest.
Resisting arrest.
And the difference there, though, I think, just briefly, is that in that circumstance, and it is real and it does happen, but that's the exception. Whereas stop and frisk policies and the sort of routine harassment is the everyday condition for low-income communities and communities of color. And that's important to
realize. Joe?
I think that most people feel like you do when they do a little bit of reading, a little bit of research, a little bit of watching here. First of all, I have great sympathy for police because I know I couldn't do it. I couldn't do that and succeed. I also have great sympathy for the individual who decides to run. You hear a lot of this. Why would you? Well, listen, if you didn't run from the police, they wouldn't. Well, as we have learned, the most poor people in this country can have their lives ruined by being arrested, even if they are innocent. There are any, and you've already walked through several of the reasons why here, Jordan. You want to get a job, you want to get credit, you want a loan, don't get arrested. And yes, the urge is often to run in that case. So who's right and who's wrong here? Often there is no clear answer. And you've got a police force, like you said, Jordan, that is set up in many cases for failure, and people who have failed before they're arrested.
Under our Constitution and under our legal, when they're running, they're still innocent.
That's correct.
They have not been before a court of law. Only the policeman has decided that they may be guilty of something.
And as we've seen over the past months, running from the police can be a very deadly move.
Lethal. Absolutely lethal. Linda, what do you think of this?
Well, I think that, you know, I feel for both the police and the community that becomes a victim of police brutality. But I think that unlike England, unlike France, unlike a lot of European countries where there's a different relationship with the police, it's different because of one thing. There aren't the guns, the proliferation of guns in those countries. And I think if we didn't have this proliferation of guns, the relationship might be quite different. We might be able to be more reasonable between, you know, police and community. But they're afraid.
I think you're very right, Linda. When a policeman stops a car, which is one of the great points where wrongdoers are discovered, there's some question whether they should stop as many cars as they do. But when he's walking up to that window, he does not know whether he will be shot.
Well, we saw this in Boston recently with the policeman who was shot point blank, you know, when he approached a car. Well, that is the difference between our cultures and something that has to be addressed.
The director is going to shoot me. We're out of time. my guests today, I thank them, Jordan Seabury. Please come back, Jordan. You're a very interesting and articulate young man. The ever delightful and brilliant Joe Matthew, and the co-host, ever delightful and brilliant, Linda Gasparello.
And young.
That's our show.